This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the ladies of Groundworks. We are so glad to be back in the studio.
It is so nice to be in air conditioning.
Yes. We've been
and
busy.
Not sweating on a rooftop.
Oh, my God. Well, it's been a really busy spring. I can't believe it's been like 3 months since we've been in here, right?
Or chasing down plants, Carmen.
Oh, my God. Plant hunting. Well, those of you who don't know us, we design and build gardens all over New York. And when we're not doing that, we're here in the studio. And the show aims to bring some culture to horticulture. And today we have a wonderful guest, Augustus Jenks Farmer.
Isn't best that a great name ever.
Yeah, best name ever. Plantsman, horticulturist, garden designer, and most recently, author of the new book, Deep Rooted Wisdom, Skills and Stories from Generations of Gardeners, which was published just this spring by Timber Press, which is our favorite garden book publisher. But before we bring Jenks on the air, we have to do our now infamous horticultural honor roll. That's the sound.
That's it, Jack. So we are doing the summer special.
Yes.
We're doing them monthly. So tune in for more specials to come. But today we're going to honor somebody we discovered in the Jenks Farmer book, Ms. Mary Gibson Henry, from 1884 to 1967. She's a little-known American botanist and plant collector from Philadelphia, who also served as president of the American Horticultural Society and the Hymenocallis is named in her honor.
Henry A. is named, yeah.
Henry A.
Yes.
Henry A., right. Sorry. So Ms. Henry had a lifelong interest in botany, and after her children had grown up, she set out collecting in her chauffeured car to remote areas of the American coastal plain, the Piedmont and Appalachian Mountains. And in later ventures, she went to the Ozarks and then the Rocky Mountains, collecting plants from New Mexico to British Columbia. As she recalled in her memoirs, "I soon learned that rare and beautiful plants can only be found in places that are difficult of access. Often one has to shove oneself through or wiggle under briars with awkward results to clothing and many deep cuts and scratches." And let me just note that Carmen cut her finger gardening this weekend. So I think she understands.
Yes.
"Wading, usually bare-legged, through countless rattlesnake-infested swamps adds immensely to the interest of the day's work."
That does not describe my gardening experience. Just so you know, I will not wade through rattlesnake-infested swamps.
"At one point, she and her daughter were held up by three armed men. As she later observed, it all took place so quickly we felt as though we were at the movies. I had often wondered how it would feel to be held up, and really it was not so bad after all." So she has a 50-acre private botanical garden that has now become the nonprofit Henry Foundation for Botanical Research, and it's open to the public. Our guest would, of course, be familiar with Miss Henry, as he is a grower of Hymenocallis, otherwise known as the Crinum lily. In fact, his nursery can be credited with helping to promote and save this typically southern plant. But besides growing lilies...
Yes, I'm going to read Augustus Jenks' bio, which doesn't do him justice, but I'm going to read it. Augustus Jenks Farmer's vision for reflective, soulful gardening guided gardeners, craftsmen, volunteers, and scientists to create two lauded public botanical gardens, as well as art museums, city parks, and private enclaves. He's listed as one of Garden and Gun's most interesting people and regularly featured in Southern Living. While his focus is on subtropical gardening in the South, he's written for international journals, appeared in John Deere commercials around the world, and writes for popular magazines and lectured across the U.S. Welcome, Jenks.
Thanks. Man, that's a big introduction.
We cover a lot of ground here.
So we're I think Miss Henry might have been a little dramatic and I don't know how, you know, I guess the polite thing to say would be a character.
Uh-huh.
So I'm pleased to be put into the category with her.
Well, it takes one to know one, right?
Yes, and I was really glad to discover her because she's, you know, this was in the 1930s and 40s that she was rambling around, not a period that people associate with botanizing or plant exploration. So it was really great to see, first of all, a woman in that role and a kind of society woman who really mm-hmm. didn't have to do that kind of work at all. She just went because she was interested. And to rise within the ranks of the Horticultural Society and to leave a legacy. So I was really glad that you put this character in your book amongst all the other characters that are in your book. But we want to talk about you. We want you to share with our listeners a little bit about your farm, your family's history with the land there, and how your family came to create that nursery there and all that you do. Tell us about that.
Okay, I should give you an idea of the scale of my farm, and in air quotes. Our production area is about 3/4 acre.
Okay.
So it's a little thing.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's still bigger than Brooklyn.
That would be worth about $10 million.
Well, it's not worth that here. But it's worth a lot to me because it is the place that I grew up, and it was a really cool, very, you know, poor little farm. It's not any kind of a plantation or anything like that, but it always was a gathering place for children. It was where, like, my cousins and cousins before me and older than me got dropped off and had a blast playing in the woods, playing on the hay bales. And I feel really lucky that I've come up with a way to make it work in a new economy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, I don't have a whole lot of capital, so I couldn't buy. I mean, I couldn't become a farmer. You know, I don't have the land to do it or the equipment. So we came up with a way that not only makes us feel like we're doing something really good for the land, but provides a income in this kind of modern war agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do and have been doing for about 15 years is have an old style field nursery. Everything's grown in just out in rows, and we specialize in crinum lilies and hymenocallis and a few other related bulbs. We dig them, wash and bleach them, and then we ship them all over the country. So we're very specialized. We've come up with a high value crop, and a crop that takes minimal capital input.
Hmm.
So you know, I'm proud that we've come up with a way, like I said, to make this old style farm operate in a new way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Are you selling retail or wholesale or both?
We sell both. We sell both. We have a website, which is just my name, jinxfarmer.com. And we do, we're cherry pickers for this plant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in crinums like daylilies or hostas, there are hundreds of different varieties, and 80% of them should never have made it into the trade.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Right? They, They're not properly tested. They were just named for somebody. I call them ego plants.
Yeah, right. You know,
I wanted to name this for myself. So the other part of my life in botanical gardens and in private gardening, I get to test all of these plants, all of these different varieties, and I only sell what I think are the best, mm-hmm. The ones that have the most appeal through the summer, the best leaves, the best mm-hmm. foliage.
And Jex,
and then we do a little bit of wholesale just okay. to some other bulb growers.
Well, let me ask you, Jex, did you choose Crinum because of its specialty and high value, or were you interested in the plant first? Tell me a little bit about, because that plant isn't really used up here.
But it originates in the South. Yeah. It originates
could be used
in the
up
South.
There.
Mm-hmm. But it's not, how hardy is it? I'm not that familiar with it. What zones is it hardy to?
Well, I've been sending Crinums to friends all over the North for years and the Midwest. I had a guy from Zone 5 send me a picture of his in flower this week.
Oh, okay. Because I think of it as a typically southern plant, mm-hmm. you know.
I know, and that's a huge issue for us. We have to overcome that in mm-hmm. order, you know, to sell you some.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend up in the hills of Connecticut who has some. Now, like any other plant, there are totally tropical ones. You just have to right. know which ones work.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly want to try some. We'll put the word out now.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, great. To get to your original question about how did I get into them, Crinums were way out of fashion when I was young. Well, I guess they kind of still are way out of fashion, but they had a peak of interest in about 1900 and again right after World War II. And I would find these, like the remnants of these plants in old gardens and cemeteries. And I dug one up that now I still have it. I dug it up when I was a boy. It was in flower 2 weeks ago. And now I've traced its history, and I found out that it's about 80 years old, this one bulb.
Wow.
And there's something, like, even as a little boy to me that was fascinating about these things that are, like, left over, but so tough, you know, but at the same time they can send out these delicate, beautiful, sort of ephemeral flowers. Something about that contrast just grabbed me when I was young.
Yeah, yeah. It's timeless, you know? I mean, literally, it is still, there's still value and it's beauty, you know? And you're right, it absolutely...
And the toughness I like. So they're native to, some of them are native to the low country, right? Is that right, Jinx?
We only have one native one. There are tons of them that occur from here down through okay. Central America, Mexico,
okay.
and into South America. But there's only one that's native here. But there are a lot of them that were distributed by various means, like pass-along plants. And
yes, yes, right. And that's so that's what I...
pass-along plants.
That's one of the things we wanted to talk about. When Jenks and I chatted... a few weeks ago in preparation for the interview, the book is so chock full of information. We decided that we were going to make this interview deep rather than broad, you know? So
right.
we kind of wanted to narrow it down. And one of the chapters that really got to me was the chapter about finding and scavenging for plants. And in each chapter, you have, you know, wisdom, information, and also you have the people, your teachers and other people that have inspired you and taught you some of the things that you know. And you mentioned quite a few times in that chapter that nurseries as we know them today are a very new concept. They only came about because of the ability for plastic to be cheap. Right. So suddenly things could be grown in containers. They could be shipped. It was a lot easier. But before that,
exactly.
most people got plants by trading with neighbors, with friends, family. and sometimes taking little cuttings from the wild or from mm-hmm. cemeteries or abandoned places. Mm-hmm. And this term appeared in that chapter called shack botany, which I had never heard before reading your book. Can you share with our listeners what does shack botany mean?
I don't know where that term comes from, but it's pretty common around here, maybe because we have more shacks than y'all do.
That's what I was, when Carmen was telling me about it, that's what I said. I was like, that's just a vernacular, simple term, for passing plants back and forth between,
Well, how do you define
people?
How do you define it?
Well, for me, shack botany, it would be going out to play, like, old farms, and going into abandoned houses, abandoned barns, and looking around the house to see what remains, and collecting from that. Mm-hmm. And so that's often bulbs, antique roses,
right.
Scuppernons and muscadines and figs are often still there. Mm-hmm. So that's what shack botany is to me, and it truly would be more common in places that have been poorer longer than other places, because here we have people living in a lot of things you would they're just you think they nobody could live in until not too long ago. We've been in an extremely poor state,
right.
so those places were often lived in and farmed and gardened into the 60s,
right.
So there's a greater cache of plants to explore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you've been scavenging since you were a child, and tell us about some of the teachers that kind of taught you about this life, so to speak. Bennett Baxley and his garden and his influence on you.
Bennett's a really cool guy. He's in his late 80s now, and I've known him my whole life. He's my godfather's cousin or something crazy like that. Let me tell you a little bit about Bennett. Do you know Pat Conroy, right? The author from South Carolina?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of his best books is called The Water is Wide, and it's about teaching in a little school on an island that has no bridge to it. And the school was still segregated. So Bennett was the last principal of the last segregated class at this school on Defusky Island.
Uh-huh. I know Defusky Island. Yeah.
So, the man's had this fascinating life. He's a country farm guy who got himself out of that, became a teacher, became a principal, saw the world, and has seen the world change drastically. But on his little farm, the things that he values the most are the plants that people give him or he gets from their gardens. Like, from living on Defusky, he can share with me and say, this plant came from these two old sisters who I rented a room from in the 60s, and he remembers people through these plants.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's lovely.
He also, as a history teacher, he also remembers bits of history and uses those plants to teach little bits of history. Like, he taught me that Bluffton, South Carolina, was one time a big collection point for a plant that we call vanilla plant. And he said you could go into Bluffton and the whole town smelled like vanilla, because people would go out into the woods, collect the leaves of this plant, bale it, and then ship it to Virginia, where it was used for flavoring cigars.
Wow. Interesting.
And what's the name of that plant?
It's so important to think that, to recognize that that was just in the 60s, that we had industries where people were going out to the wild collecting things.
Right, right.
That seems like such a different world.
And the plant is called Nilla, you said, Jinx?
Vanilla.
But what is the plant? Is it, what actually is the plant?
I'm sorry, I don't have the common name. I mean, I'm... I don't have the scientific name.
But it's not the vanilla orchid, obviously. It's just,
no,
it's just
not.
Smells like
that. Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at. Okay.
That's interesting because you think about the 60s and you think about it already being extremely modernized and industrial. But
right.
There were very,
you think about the highways going through.
Yeah,
and, right.
There were very many parts of the United States.
It was still rural, right?
Yeah, I always tell Alice stories about my family, and we talked about it briefly, Jenks, how in the 1960s, my parents, on my mother's side, my grandparents didn't have running water or electricity until the mid-60s on their farm in Italy. It just didn't come.
I went to school in southwestern Virginia, and in a little town called Radford, and 30% of that county did not have running water in 1986.
Wow.
That's in
1986?
1986 was my freshman year of college, 30%. Because it was, you know, an hour and a half southwest of Roanoke. So it's still pretty country. Yeah, it's beautiful country, but, you know, it was very hard for me there coming from the suburbs of Connecticut.
That's a big change.
I didn't stay there for too long, but it was an interesting place, you know.
Yeah,
well,
and
I think it's
people.
So important that, I mean, obviously none of us want to go back to those times, but I think it's so important to realize that it's not that far away from us, and particularly for young people. And I really wrote this book for young people who are removed from farms today. But I think it's so important that we realize that it wasn't that long ago that things were totally different. And some of the things that we don't like about modern horticulture and modern agriculture can be changed by looking back to the way things used to be done.
Yeah, yeah. I read this great book. I can't think of the name of it right now, but it's about Eudora Welty wrote an intro to it, but it was basically about the marketplace and how people distributed seeds, and that was the connection between the communities, was like seed swaps. You know, back in the early 60s and, you know, from the 30s on, that was really how, if you were in rural communities, you got the information that you needed about what was going on in the towns. And, you know, it was through plants and through seeds. And now, you know, we've got apps for everything. And it's just, like you said, it really is for the young people that don't have those connections.
Because it's only been a generation or two that's come away from the land, right, Jenks? I mean, really,
it depends on where you're from, of course. Some places it's more like four, but I think a lot of young people, you know, my sister, who's too busy, she's taking her kids to piano and all of that. She wants to maintain that connection, but it's tough.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm lucky. I have the time. I get to go around, and like, I was sitting with this 85-year-old guy today talking about the nursery industry.
Yeah.
So I hope that I can tell some of those stories and do it in a way that that the people who would like to do that but are too busy can hold on to them.
Exactly. And that's exactly why we do this radio show and why we try and bring these topics, you know, to the forefront, because people are so removed from where their food comes from and just the plants and their gardens, and everybody wants to be a gardener, and you look at these sexy shelter magazines and beautiful photos, and yet you don't have a clue, you know, where those plants come from.
We found a lot of we work for a lot of well-educated,
high-heeled
people here in New York, and they don't really understand nature. They're very far removed, so part of our job a lot of the time is to educate
just
a little bit about
slow down,
you know. And speaking of education, so we talked about how things have changed and people aren't going, most people aren't going now and pulling plants from the wild. And I like that you put in your book some some advice and some guidelines, because times are different. Some species are extinct, some are under severe threat of extinction, and so you go into a bit of depth on that subject in your book. Can you share a little bit about that, what was called the International Code of Ethics for Plant Collectors? There's, you know, a little bit of what you should consider nowadays if you want to go and collect plants.
I think it's important to distinguish the kind of collecting that code is really referring to from the collecting that most people would do on a Saturday morning.
Okay.
And that code is a great guide even for the Saturday morning collector. But it's, if you're going out into the wild, into national parks, into, you know, Mexico, that sort of thing, the code is really addressing that. And particularly if you're going into places where there are unique plants or things that need to be protected. So the code says things like, if you're going to collect seeds, you should only collect, I think it's 30% of the total seed population,
mm-hmm.
so that you leave a population there to replenish.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And not only that, but you have to know whether or not somebody else is collecting those seeds.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Because everybody's 30% quickly adds on.
Yes.
Right.
We don't want to be like those 19th century.
If you're walking around downtown or in the, you know, the local cemetery, if you're going to an abandoned Dairy Queen, those are totally different things, but they're
exactly.
great places to get plants.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because whatever survived there between the cracks of the concrete or in the mess of weeds is probably pretty tough, you know?
Right.
And survived on
right.
neglect, you know? You told a great story, Jenks. I'm digressing for a second. Whose mother was it that was putting azalea cuttings in her purse? Like, that was such a great story.
That was my friend Bennett, and he
was mortified.
He said he remembered when he was a little boy, her doing that, and he knew that's wrong. You know, that's stealing.
She was taking azalea cuttings, like, on the courthouse, right,
yeah.
like, in the square, and putting them in
right.
her purse, right?
I gotta have this color. This is a great color.
Right.
Oh, my God.
I'm not gonna buy it.
Well, you guys should read the book to find out more details about sort of the guy. You also give some pretty common sense ones for people who are amateurs, you know, who will go to the abandoned Dairy Queen or the back of a tavern, you know, and collect some seed. You give some good basic guidelines of what's right and sensible so that we don't, you know, overexploit
right.
Plant populations.
Right.
You know, sometimes we think too about collecting has to be like, I'm collecting this rare thing. Nobody else has it. For me, it's not that. I have a rose that I collected at our local microbrewery.
That's awesome.
And I love it. And I know, you know, it's just old blush. It grows everywhere. But I love it because it came from there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, the next morning, like, sticking the rose in and going through the process of rooting it.
Yeah.
I think just learning the process, it's an important skill. You may not use it all that much, but you might.
Yeah.
Who knows?
We have a flowering almond that we have taken all over the eastern seaboard with us because it was my great-grandma's in Michigan. And we just keep, you know, every time we move, and we just keep giving cuttings to the cousins. And it's awesome. Like, that thing is all over
the
United
States
now.
It's really great to share that. I did the same thing with a grape, a seedless white grape that my dad planted about 40 years ago. And every year when I cut the grape hard, I take cuttings and I pass them along to friends, whoever wants them, you know, that as far away as, you know, Vermont. I sent some to my in-laws in Kansas,
yeah.
you know, and this like little Italian urban grape that he planted that's still producing, by the way.
It produces grape.
Yeah.
Great.
I love sharing the cuttings, and it's so easy to do. And
mm-hmm.
it's so much more
personal
than going out to the garden center, buying a plant. And when
some pesticide-laced plant.
Yeah, and when you go and buy it, you just don't have as much invested in it. You just, it's kind of almost right. disposable. If it doesn't make it, well, you know, it has no personal history for you.
Right.
You know, when I pass along that grape to a friend, I feel like I'm passing along my family's history mm-hmm. a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
And they feel like that, too. The person getting it feels that
yeah.
value, too.
They're more protective of it, and they're more aware of it. And it's not just the $4 Home Depot, you know, sale item. It's Carmen's grape. Like, oh, I better get out there and...
And water it.
You know,
right.
do something
right.
with it. Yeah. Well, I
you know, when we do cuttings in the winter. We do dormant cuttings in the ground in the winter here. And whenever I do, even to, like, I do presentations to master gardeners and symposiums and things like that. When I talk about that, when I say, I'll even bring with me, here, you know, here are 150 cuttings from pruning my fig.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, what do you mean? I can just stick this in the ground?
Yeah.
And these are educated people.
They're like, yes.
They're so blown away and charmed, and there's just such a connection by learning that that thing has life in it. You know, you can just put that little dried up stem in the ground, and it's going to be a fig tree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's quite miraculous. People are always amazed. They're like, what are you doing with those sticks in a pot? I usually do mine in a pot because I have to, you know, it's easier to water and to pass along. And they're like, what are those
right.
brown sticks in a pot? I said, those are grape cuttings. And they say, well, they look dead. And I said, well, come back in 2 weeks and you'll see that they're very much not dead.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And they're
right.
always, they're right. astounded, you mm-hmm. know, they're astounded that there's that much life force, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Life force.
Well, we have to take a break, Jenks.
Hang on to the line.
Hang on.
And you stay tuned to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Today's guest is Jenks Farmer. We're delving today into the question of who taught you to garden?
Yes.
And what?
And your garden memories.
And your garden memories. You know, Jenks, we were supposed to spend half the time on one topic and another, and we've kind of eaten into most of our time today talking about scavenging and stories, and I don't mind.
No, it's
at
been
all.
A lovely.
Actually, I think it's been.
I wish we could talk more.
More, but we've kind of come close to the end. We just kept on chatting. I think
give us a quick rundown of
yeah.
watering.
Yes,
let's talk quickly
yeah.
about watering. You have some good thoughts on that. What's your technique, Jenks?
You know, I do. I really believe in hand watering, and I believe that a lot of irrigation systems are so poorly used that they hurt the plants and they waste water. And I work with a campus and an agricultural project in Haiti, and to see it's just beyond, it just hurts my heart to know how many people would use that water that's getting sprayed by so many
right.
unneeded systems. So I believe that every time you plant a plant, the most important thing to do is to submerge mm-hmm. that plant in a bucket of water before you plant it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That gets those roots wetter. I don't know that's appropriate to say, but
right.
that gets the root ball more saturated than you could possibly get it from watering with a hose.
Yeah.
Or watering with an irrigation system. So every time I plant, I submerge and then plant that wet root ball. And then I think the whole idea of watering by hand helps you learn and helps you see the cycles of the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, it helps you slow down and observe because you're just standing there.
I agree.
Watching.
And Alice and I, we have so many issues with irrigations that we constantly have. I mean, we install them for people's gardens because they will not go out there and water. Jenks. They will not do it.
Right.
But we constantly reiterate to them, it is not, you have to still manage it. It is not a human. It doesn't have eyes, you know? If you have five cloudy days and you have a rain sensor, it's still going to go off.
Right.
You have to pay attention to the weather, to your plants. But it's like, it's really a struggle because they just want it to be easy and kind of robotic, you know?
Right.
So sometimes that's really frustrating, you know? We totally hear you.
or sometimes it's
enough. I do too occasionally. I do the best I can, and I always do drip if that's an option.
Yeah.
But, you know, for that chapter, because I didn't want to seem like such a freak, so I went and found some people who would validate those experiences.
Right.
Yeah.
And Ryan Gainey is, he's one of America's most important older garden designers. He was one of the few Americans who was featured in Gardens of the World. You know that old Audrey Hepburn PBS?
Yeah, yes, right. Yes, yes.
And he said the same thing. And then Jim Martin is a young farmer who does organic vegetables in Charleston. And same thing. He said, you know, they tell us we have to have drip systems. And he said, I don't do it. He said, I just do it by hand in rain. And he runs his business that way.
That's right.
I know. I mean, New York, we get 47 inches of rain on average a year. And it's pretty spread out across all the months. So theoretically, rain for in-ground gardens, rain should be enough. And my own garden is testament to that. I don't use any irrigation systems. I hand water. And it's one of the great pleasures because when you're watering, like Alice said, you are interacting with the plants. You observe if there's any insect problems. You observe if there's disease, if one plant is kind of dominating another. Irrigation systems take that away from you, you know?
Right.
And until they can make them, you know, smarter, better, I think, you know, use them sparingly.
Well, and also just the overwatering that can happen sometimes too. And then
waste.
And then clients are like, but, you know, I just kept watering and watering thinking that's what the plant needed. And no, let that plant dry out, you know? And you only know that by looking at it.
And touching the soil and interacting. Yeah. Well, we could spend an hour just on watering, but I wanted to remind people to get your book. It's an amazing book. You know, when Alice and I got it from Timber, we were like, we want to have him on the show right away.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, we have to wait until it comes out in print. Deep Rooted Wisdom, Skills and Stories from Generations of Gardeners, published by Timber Press. You can get so much out of that, young, old, experienced, novice. Please get the book.
And it makes you want to garden. Like,
yes,
it's so delicious.
Yeah, the photography is great too, Jenks. I really loved
Thank you.
It's really...
I had, you know, a lot of it's mine.
I figured that.
So many friends have donated, you know, and let me use their pictures.
It's a beautiful book, you know. It's
very personal.
And we're doing, right now, we're doing Father's Day gifts. So if you want to send the book with an inscribed note, you can order it from my website. But it's on Timber and Amazon and all those kind of things, too.
It's a great book for a dad, I think.
Oh, I'm definitely getting this for my father. A few years ago, I got him a membership to the Southern Garden Society. Me and my dad.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And I think, Alice, you subscribe to Garden and Gun.
I do. Yes. I do.
She's a reader.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, Jenks, we've run out of time. We're going to have you back next season to talk more. We really enjoyed talking with you. I want to leave our listeners with one final phrase from your book that really, really stayed with me, and it was, the spirit of the place is always the main ingredient. And I thought that was really, really great. Thank you for being our guest.
And thank you for your book. It's lovely.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks, y'all. I enjoyed it.
Great. Well, you've been listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. A special thanks go out to our sponsor. The show has been produced and engineered by the wonderful Jack Inslee. Please remember to join our Facebook fan page to stay current on our projects and our upcoming shows. And you can win free stuff. Thanks for listening.
We Dig Plants.
See you in the garden.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.